You are listening to the Streets MN Podcast, a place where conversations about Minnesota's transportation and land use are expanded through research and informed commentary.
Hi, this is Bill Indicke. Welcome to the Streets.MN podcast, episode 116, St. Paul 1978, with George Latimer, Jerry Mathiason, and David Lanigren. Today I have a fun conversation for you that I taped back in May. The chat took place between former St. Paul Mayor George Latimer, a photographer named Jerry Mathiason, and McAllister geography professor David Lanigren. They discussed St. Paul 1978 in this photo exhibit at the Landmark Center as part of an exhibition of Mathiason's photographs from downtown St. Paul in 1978. St. Paul 1978 is an interesting place and time to think about. It was a year before I was born, and I've always been fascinated with what the U.S. looked like and what downtown politics and city politics looked like back in that time period. What were people thinking back then? Why did they think, for example, it was a great idea to bulldoze many of the historic buildings and build instead mega block shopping mall projects that, to me, at least in retrospect, seemed doomed to fail? Places like the Town Square development, which is a urban indoor park, or Galtier Plaza, which is a large, originally it was a shopping mall, and now it's sort of an office complex that's struggling to attract tenants. Why did they build these projects, and what was the problem they were trying to solve? Looking at the old pictures is to see a very different St. Paul. Vast empty lots downtown, granted there are still some of those today, but combined with sort of a 70s-era urban squalor, sidewalks and streets designed around cars, intermingling with historic pre-war people-centered architecture. Mickey's Diner is still there, of course. It's a fascinating time period, and I've just been kind of curious about this period of time for a long time. That's why I was so excited when the exhibit and discussion popped up on my calendar earlier this spring. The discussion was part of a display in a small side room / museum in the Landmark Center, another example of a project that was rescued from the same, and all the photos are from the same time period in the summer of 1978 when Mathiason was going around the streets of downtown St. Paul and photographing lots of places that were changing quickly. The three of those people, Latimer, Lanigren, and Mathiason, had a discussion. You might know George Latimer from him being mayor. He was sort of a famous figure in St. Paul history. He was the mayor from 1976 to 1990, which is a huge amount of time, and so he shaped a lot of what exists today in downtown St. Paul. And the three of them chatted about St. Paul, some of the old stories, the old war stories of being involved in city politics 40 years ago, and whether or not downtown leaders like Latimer and others might have made any mistakes along the way of creating downtown St. Paul that you see today. And there are some interesting answers to questions like that. I want to thank the Ramsey County Historical Society and the Landmark Center Museum for hosting the forum and allowing me to tape the proceedings. The chat was about an hour long and full of interesting tidbits about St. Paul history, downtowns in the 70s, and economic development schemes like the notorious never-built St. Paul, quote, people mover. So that gets mentioned, so look forward to that. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Before we begin, though, I want to give a shout-out to the sponsor for this podcast, who's Nate Pence, who's a realtor with Pence Homes at Keller Williams Classic Realty Northwest. If you are interested in buying or selling a house, or if you know someone who is, you can support our sponsor, who's this wonderful guy, Nate Pence. Start your own home search at PenceHomes.com. That's P-E-N-T-Z Homes.com. And if you have any questions about buying or selling process, shoot him a message at Nate@PenceHomes.com. Or you can call him at 612-308-1122. So we're going to hear from him later on in this discussion with another of the Ask a Realtor series of conversations. So this one is about sort of training that realtors get when they are first starting to be realtors and getting their license, about the history of sort of you know, housing and racism in America. It's one of the questions I've always had in my mind. And so I talked to Nate about it. So look forward to that too. So on with the show.
Well, I'm Dave Lannegren. I'm a professor of geography at McAllister College. And I spent quite a bit of time in this building as we were restoring it, and did a little bit for the Planning Commission when His Honor here was the mayor. We've got a very interesting set of people here, if you exclude me. But the program here is sponsored by Minnesota Landmarks, which is the organization responsible for the maintenance of this building. And the building is owned and sponsored by Ramsey County. The other partner in the program is Historic St. Paul. And we are asking that you silence your cell phones, which is, I guess, kind of a ritual now before all public gatherings. So if you would be quietly, especially, why don't you just put yours away, George? You interrupted, but you know that's what this is all about. A panel discussion is made for interruptions. That's why I've taken the microphone. So after we go through our little set of questions here, we'll open it up to the floor and you can ask questions, and then we encourage you to go down and visit the exhibit in the North Gallery if you haven't done so already. Actually, but I'm very good at spilling things, so magic will appear in a second here, and we won't get electrocuted. Our photographer has a long pedigree, I guess I'll say, of interesting photographs in the Twin Cities and around the nation. He graduated from the University of Minnesota with a degree in fine arts, and according to the bio here, as a very young man in the middle 60s, he photographed Hubert Humphrey's family. So I assume he must have been about 10 or something like that. Since graduating, he's had a long career, as I said, in various forms of photography, and primarily now in these last decade or so, photographing buildings and sort of architectural and historical records. I think most of you know the man to my right. He is, the longest serving mayor, or he has the record for longevity among St. Paul mayors. He was mayor from 1976 to 1990, and then moved to the Hamline Law School and was the dean there for a while. And then in 93, he joined the federal government and was an advisor to Henry Cisneros, the secretary of HUD. And then from 96 to 2005, he served as a distinguished visiting professor at McAllister College, again setting a record for the longest visitor at the college. No, that's not going to work, Judy.
Yes, it will.
Why don't you finish drying off the table?
Well, I hope I don't tip over the whole table when I pass this thing over to George. Jerry Matheson, would you start us off by telling us a little bit about what prompted this series of photos and what you were trying to capture as you looked at the city?
I have back in 78, I had a casual friend who was a graphic designer. A graphic designer. And he asked me if I would, and he had this pamphlet or brochure that he wanted to produce, and it was for this this kind of utopian sounding proposal to the state legislature, the Downtown People Mover. And I was requested to go to downtown St. Paul This was so late summer, early fall of 1978. And photograph street scenes. The designer was interested in seeing modes of transportation and how people interacted with the environment. And then also was requested to photograph in the skyways, because that's a mode of transportation. And not so many of those photos are in the show. We kind of stuck to street scenes, but so I photographed a lot of small businesses around the area, and even a lot of scenes of the freeway, which hasn't really changed much since then. But the idea was to get a feel for what the street life in downtown St. Paul was like. And these images were used in this brochure as kind of background illustrations to the text and a lot of academic development plans. And I was personally kind of disappointed because he used a graphic design on all the pictures and they are not full-tone images, and I was, you know, I printed all these pictures and made them just great, and then he ran them through, you know. It wasn't Photoshop in 78, by the way. So my project was to really illustrate a feel for downtown St. Paul at that time.
Can you give us a sense of what you thought about downtown St. Paul in 78?
Well, I had worked in downtown St. Paul periodically. Well, actually, before this, only once. I worked at the Minnesota Museum of Art when I was in the Science Museum on 10th and St. Peter, just for a few months. And so my experience with downtown St. Paul was not tremendous. I mean, I just kind of wandered around. It was a great assignment. There wasn't an art director standing over my shoulder saying, take a picture of this, get a picture of that. You know, it was very loose, and it was a kind of street photography that I had done earlier as a photographer in the early and mid-60s, or mostly mid-60s. And so it was a very enjoyable process. I can't remember how many times I went downtown, but not when it was raining.
Did anybody react to you when you took their picture?
Well, I suppose. I have a few where the people on the street are looking at me with, daggers.
You know, as an artist and a photographer as an artist, tell us, what did you think about the scape that you were looking at?
Well, I
and
was...
be candid.
Yeah. It's hard to remember what you were thinking 40 years ago, but I was more interested at that point in getting these street photographs that had a kind of choreography to them. So I wasn't really thinking about, well, what does it look like? You know, looking back on it, I can see that downtown St. Paul was quite different at that time. But I was much more familiar with downtown Minneapolis, and it just seemed like more of a village.
Okay. Mayor of the village, you took over in the 70s. We will, but first I want to ask you a more general question. So when you became, I know you would, but I'm not going to let you do that. That's why they have a moderator here. Would you give us some idea of when you became mayor, what you thought about downtown St. Paul and the directions that you thought it might move?
Well, even though the DPM, which is one of the first things you mentioned, was a disaster, my perception that Mayor Vavilis and I were opponents during that election. And everywhere we, can everyone hear me okay? I'm like Domingo. Domingo is now a baritone, you know. And now I'm a baritone and going downhill. And it was striking, and I think if George were here, he would agree with me, that wherever we went, in the neighborhoods and everything else, people wanted to know, what are you going to do about downtown? So it wasn't like someone created that as a campaign theme. That's what people wanted. And of course, the first thing we offered on the plate, they said, no, wrong, try something else. But it was very striking. There was a unified sense. And especially if you did not grow up here, as I did not, you would hear these wonderful stories about how West 7th Street and the rest were really great places to go downtown, and now it was gone, that kind of thing.
I've asked you many times before if you had a plan, and I know the answer, but maybe you should tell the audience what your plan was.
Opportunism. Not in a venal sense, but when I worked with David's students and my students over the years, hi, Raphael. When I worked with the students and looking back, I wasn't that conscious of it, but so much of what we did, even with the wonderful people like Dick Broeker and several people who are in the room who really did think long range and planned, the fact is we were very opportunistic. There was money out there for the DPM, so we chased after that money. So we did an awful lot of that. And looking back, it's, if one could be sobered by it, one would be, because we really, fortunately, we had a great planning commission, and we had thoughtful citizens, and so they kind of gradually evolved. And of course, to be fair to the business community, Phil Nason and Operation 85 and wonderful tall guy, Bob Van Hoff, really they did a lot of thinking about the future of downtown. And they had Operation 85 started. And so some of our energy came from the private sector's view. And my sense when I ran for mayor with Vavilis, or against each other, my sense was that it was really there and ready. The people wanted it. The downtown community were thinking hard about it. The sense of community was rich. It was just a question of bringing people together and getting them to brainstorm in the best way, move ahead. Did I answer your question?
See, he had no plan, but.
But isn't that true of most urban development? It tends to be more organic than.
Opportunistic.
Well, no, opportunistic is kind of organic, as opposed to laid out by urban planners on carefully drawn up.
Right. Well,
with idea. Ideal situations.
We did have a very nice plan. It's just that we had a mayor who wasn't going to follow our plan. That was the problem. But the People Mover was just one of those intellectual plans that came into a built environment. That I don't know how many of you remember the 1970s. From the looks of you, probably a lot of you were there in the 1970s. But you may remember the times back then. You know, the war in Vietnam had just ended, and people were thinking about what was going on in the cities, and engineering was in the rise. People thought technology could solve a lot of problems, and the People Mover was one of those technical problems to an organic situation.
Would you describe what the People Mover was? Because I don't think very many people know what it was supposed to be and do.
The People Mover was a big scale version of the system used in military armament plants to move explosives. So sleds moved along on a cushion of air. And so there were no wheels under these sleds. They just moved on this cushion of air. And if anything happened, the air would stop and these things would stop automatically. So it was to bring in this very interesting transportation technology and run it like moving sidewalks through the built environment in downtown St. Paul as a way to get people to move around and shop and spend time when they're on their lunch hour and hour afterwards in the downtown. There was also plans to run it out into the community, which were never really formalized into a plan. But let's talk about the riverfront. Judy, can you show us those pictures? So nothing is still existing here except the river, of course, and the head house of the grain elevators. Next one. Where did you take this picture from?
I have no idea. Is that from the Bluffs?
Yeah, you're on either a bridge or in a building with a telephoto, I'm guessing.
Well, I did use a variety of lenses, yeah. But...
No, that's the high bridge. Could have been from that Wabasha Bridge, yeah.
Is that the high bridge?
That's the high bridge, yeah.
Oh, okay. All right.
You remember how the road... I think there's another one, isn't there, Judy?
I was told that it was under construction. And that's the Wabasha Bridge, of course. It's not there anymore.
And I think there's one more, isn't there? This is a really nice one. So do you remember, or can you make up a story of what you were thinking about when you took that picture?
Well, I did spend a lot of time down on Shepherd Road because it was visually very rich with all the grain trucks going into the elevator and all these trains, and it was it had a kind of a vacant lot look to it with the elegant landmark center in the background and is that the library on the right-hand
right.
side? But it otherwise had a very rundown kind of 1930s feel about it, about the space.
Well, it looks like it. You know, from the academic side, it looks like it was carefully composed to get that, by then, an obsolete freight car juxtaposed to the Minnesota Club and buildings downtown. George, you want to say anything? Okay. I'm gratified. One more, I think. That's the same one. Well, George, you do have to say something because the Riverfront Corporation was your brainchild, so I'll pass it to you.
Well, the love of the river is sort of universal. That's why people built so much around water. When deindustrialization was really taking hold in St. Paul, remember, we lost Brown and Bigelow, American Hoist and Derrick, Whirlpool. I'm probably leaving out something. Well, of course, that came a little bit later. I was talking about like back then when we started the riverfront. So it became pretty clear that the loss of industry also invited a wonderful return to where the river had taken us in the first place. And so, and p- people really rallied around the idea. It was kind of like when we did the reforestation after the Dutch elm disease. There were some things that so unified everybody in St. Paul across class and neighborhood and everywhere. And the love of trees was one, love of the river another. And so that motivated us. And I think we floundered. We spent the first period, Alan Lovejoy's here, maybe later he can comment a little bit about this, but at the beginning we were doing the right things, which was clearing it and preparing it. But along the way, we bungled badly. If I'm moving too far ahead, just cut me off. I thought one of the big blunders, and Jack Heschler's here, he can comment. One of the big blunders was when we were clearing all that, when Jerry Troyan, who next to Trump is certainly the person most people like to hate of the people I've listened to. I never hate, but I could feel that. And so when Troyan offered to buy the Amhoist property, I'll never forget how many acres it was, but it was a lot. And I can remember my usually superb civil servants from PED and me looking out there, and I won't name the SOB who was the head of your operation at the time, but they were really good people. But I said, we better make sure that that's publicly owned property, all of that. And he said, don't worry about it, Mayor. That guy doesn't have the resources, and he won't be able to outbid us. He did. And then, after he did, the downtown community and most of my advisors said that we ought not to permit him to use tax increment financing in order to build that glass tower that he built. Remember the first building, the revenue building? And I took the kind of obstinate legal view. I said, we hand out tax increment like candy all over downtown. This guy outbid us fair and square. And so I really respect that property invites tax increment financing. We're going to permit that too. So that was a big political issue, that we ought not to be helping a developer at that side of the river because we need a development on the inside. But he got it fair and square. But that was a big, big loss. I can't overstate it. Not having all of that in public land. I think I've said enough for now.
Judy, can you back up to that one picture of this one? I think this is an excellent photograph because it captures the 1970s really clearly. In those years, people had argued that the cities had turned their backs on the river or the oceanfront. They have to be a seaport. And so there was a widespread view all around the world that riverfronts should be redesigned, re-envisioned. And I encourage you all to take a drive down there and see how successful that rebuilding of the riverfront at that site has been with housing and the entertainment functions and a very diminished power plant. The 70s was the era of the Back to the Cities movement. And many academics and political leaders were arguing that there would be a rebirth of the central city as people moved back. And one of the presidents of the banks in downtown St. Paul said to me once that, well, as soon as gas gets to be 75 cents a gallon, we'll see people giving up the suburban locations and moving back into downtown. So some of the assumptions that we had back then were not well grounded in reality, but this interest in revisioning the river or revisioning the waterfront or turning a landscape of production to a landscape of consumption worked really well. It took much longer than George initially envisioned for the riverfront to be developed. And I guess you could say.
The political part of that, looking, and it really, it does help, even though it's painful, to live long enough to look back. And the fact is that administrations do flag. And the energy in my administration was centered, we had a lot of wonderful people. But Dick Broeker was something else. He was the strongest, brightest, most idealistic person I have ever had the pleasure and privilege of working with. So, number one on a politics, I ran for governor. No one knew it, but I did. And running for governor when you're mayor is sort of like leaving your girlfriend. Is that too sexist? Well, the hell with you. It's like leaving your girlfriend and then not coming back. So the relationship with the city and the mayor is a very intimate one. And I loved it, and I think most people enjoyed it. But when I ran for governor, that was sort of like, okay, that's ending. In addition to that, we had a lot of civil servants had moved along and out. And so that's a long way of saying to you that you have to look at that politics and the flagging of the administration to realize that in the last 4 years of late 80s, I don't think we were permanently damaged because Norm Coleman picked that up and he collaborated with the business community and he really did a great job in moving on the river, which we really were ready to do, you know, 3 or 4 years earlier. In the long run, of course, I don't think we suffered from it, but from the standpoint of the momentum we had, I think we lost it.
Okay, so we're going to stop for a second here and jump into a visit with Nate Pence from Pence Homes at Keller Williams Northwest to talk about the Ask a Realtor question. And so, yeah, I hope you enjoy it and stay tuned. Hey, Nate, well, how are you doing today?
Good. How are you doing, Bill?
It's really warm.
It's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no snow on the ground anymore.
Yeah. Sun is shining. So first, let's introduce you. You're a realtor. I'm going to ask you a question. This segment's called Ask a Realtor.
Ask a Realtor. Nate Pence here with Pence Homes, Keller Williams Classic Realty Northwest, PenceHomes.com. Get all that blurb in there.
PenceHomes.com.
Yep.
P-E-N-T-Z.
Yes.
Got it. Okay, well, my question for you today is, I've always been curious about what kind of training you get to be a realtor.
Realtor.
What do you have to learn? What do they tell you? What are the rules when you're learning and getting your license and stuff?
Yeah, so it's 90 hours of class. So it's 3 30-hour classes, and you have a total of 5 tests, one test after each of those 30-hour blocks, plus a national and state exam for Minnesota. Every state is different. And so you basically learn a lot about, I mean, the first 30 hours is you learn a lot of stuff that you actually never use in real estate school, in real estate. Torrens, what abstract a title.
I don't even want to ask you what those things are.
I can't tell you. You just memorize it for a test,
okay.
Right? Lot blocks, different stuff like that. It's basically a lot of stuff to learn about how not to get sued. You don't really learn a lot about how to practice real estate or best practices. That's something you learn at your brokerage a lot of times, mm-hmm. or you're supposed to. It's just a lot of the stuff is learning just how to not get sued. You don't learn how to write a purchase agreement, really. You don't really learn. You learn really a little bit about how to put together comparables, like what a home might be worth if you're listing it or if you're going to put an offer in to see what the value is. So it's basically, the joke is you basically learn how not get sued.
You know, that's a common theme of the St. Paul Zoning Committee also. the city attorney is there for our meetings and he is... That it's like a subtext. It's like, we're trying not to get sued.
Yep.
Not always successfully.
Yep.
At least the city.
Yeah.
But I think it's probably much more serious if you're an individual.
Yeah. I mean, you do learn about, like, there's ethics training, too, about what proper, you know, ethics as a realtor are certain things you don't do. Like, you don't sign cross is a saying where if someone has a sign in their yard or they've signed a representation agreement either to buy or to sell a house with an agent, you're violating the ethics of the Minnesota area, the Minneapolis Area Association of Realtors, if you were to go and try to win their business after they've already signed paperwork, right? So there's some stuff like that.
Like turf,
too.
Kind of.
Yeah, I mean, if someone signed a representation agreement, then you stop talking. Yeah. You can't.
So, but I guess my question was about the history of real estate, which is a little checkered in the United States.
Sure.
And how much do you get taught that? Like, so the rule that I heard about was, you can't tell people that this is a bad neighborhood or
fair housing
steering practices and
fair housing violations. Yeah.
How about that stuff? Do you?
Yeah.
Learn
so
about that?
We learn a little bit. You talk about blockbusting. You talk about redlining a little bit, but you don't really talk about like the background to it. You talk about like
so you when
can't
you say blockbusting, define that. What does that mean?
Whew, putting me on the quiz. Blockbusting is the going and saying to potential other people in a neighborhood. They say, hey, X person here of this sort of ethnicity or orientation is moving in. You should move out of the neighborhood because of X, Y, and Z reason, right? That would be considered blockbusting.
Okay.
Red line steering is also steering people around from neighborhoods for certain reasons to say, this neighbor, you can't. So what that looks like in terms of fair housing is we can't say by law, this is a good neighborhood. This doesn't have crime. This neighborhood has crime. It's bad. We also talk about redlining a little bit. You don't really learn the history about the federal government's use of redlining with FHA backed mortgages up until the late 1960s. You don't learn anything in that regard about that. You just learn that you can't discriminate based on race, gender, creed, marital status, orientation, sexual orientation, familial status, access to public assistance.
I think you got them all.
Yeah.
Yeah. The practical classes.
I think so.
Yeah.
Old car is what we call it.
Old
so
car?
That's just the abbreviation. Oh. You use to memorize. So,
wow.
Yeah.
That's actually, I'm really glad to just ask you that just to learn old car.
Old car.
Cool. So yeah, it's just sort of interesting, and I wonder how much you think about that at all when you're sort of doing your business, or if it's something that's in the back of your mind a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I advise people if that's something that you're concerned about in terms of looking for a neighborhood, you know, the best thing to do is look at crime maps, right? But I honestly think the best thing to do really is just to kind of look at the neighborhood that you're living in and look at how well the homes are maintained, how well the cars are maintained, and that tells you a lot about your neighbors. When we bought our house up in North Minneapolis, Jess.
That's your wife.
My wife, Jess. Yeah. She actually went and talked to the neighbors and knocked on the doors and asked them how long they lived there, if they like living there. Talked to our neighbor, Ruth, and Liz and Sarah across the street. And you learn about that. And that's what, you know, that's what we did. And yeah.
Cool. Yeah. So it's just interesting to me that realtors get trained and that there's some classes you have to go to.
Yeah, we have to do a fair housing there's an ethics and fair housing continuing education that you have to do every year to stay licensed.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for answering one of my questions today.
Yeah.
And I'll catch you next time.
We'll talk soon. Okay. Thanks, Bill.
Okay, we're returning to our regular podcast with George Latimer, David Landegren, and Jerry Mathiasen. I put the break in here because someone in the audience asked a question that was inaudible in the recording. The question was about reusing old industrial buildings along the waterfront, specifically the building that's called the Head House. It's an old grain elevator that has now become the Red River Kitchen Restaurant right off the river in downtown St. Paul. The questioner asked about the worth of reusing industrial property along the river and some of the tensions between historic preservation versus the practical reusing of buildings that could or maybe should be torn down because they don't have any sort of practical reuse.
Jack isn't introducing this, but he triggered it in my mind. I have this idea that we have overrated verticality. And the big theme was to make sure that along the river that all the housing did not obstruct anything behind, including the people up in West 7th, Irvine Park and West 7th. And I learned over many batterings over my head just to do what they told me. But seriously, I can remember in Seattle and other beautiful riverfront places in which you do have vertical structures. And as we look forward to the architectural work at the Ford plant, I really hope that we open our mind to this idea that you could easily create a density that would be very economic and also build it architecturally in a way to really respect everything around it. I don't think we've given enough attention to this, and we've just marched to the ideology that along the flats we keep everything flat. And I in retrospect, I think that was a mistake.
I want to point out that Jack's been very consistent in his opinion about this building, as well as being vocal. So let's move to West 7th. Okay. Yeah, I'm going to have Jerry comment.
Well, this I included this in the show because those little girls were just rotting around on the street. I have another, probably three or four other frames of these girls, and they were kind of curious about me, I think, you know, running around with a camera. And we picked this one because it really shows where they were, if you can envision that space now. You can't see this scene from where I took the picture because giant high-rises are there now. The Ecolab building and, Travelers Insurance, is that the other one? And, of course, the Civic Center is gone. But when I was working on these images, it occurred to me that these lovely young girls, I'm guessing eight, somewhere around eight, well, now they're 48. I wonder if any of them will notice that they're in these in this show. I don't remember this spot at all. But it was part of what I was supposed, you know, I was kind of delegated to show, and it had to do with transportation, you know, what, you know, and so my mind must have said, oh yeah, well, we have this fabulous cathedral and a really enormous parking lot as an image, and it kind of was the mindset of that era, you know, the whole business of how we deal with cars in the cities, which we haven't yet sorted out, but the People Mover was supposed to deal with that, right?
I think this is a really astounding comment on the times, because we were all aware of the assets of the city, but there were these major forces pulling population out of the city, jobs and shopping out of the city, and the question of, you know, how do we transform that parking lot or these vacant lands or these derelict buildings into something more positive and attractive. Okay, is there a next one?
On this one, and I'm not exactly sure where I was standing, but the Kessler and McGuire funeral home down on the left is now being turned into a high rise. It was torn down last year. And in my historic building photography, I was assigned to photograph that particular building because it was a Catholic Charities I'm not sure what it. Yeah, yeah, it was yeah. It was Catholic Charities after the funeral home. And so I found it really interesting that I got to photograph that building in 78 and went back and photographed it extensively in 2017. So
it's
this, no, I don't have the nows downstairs. I did a lot of then and now photography with Larry Millette and the Twin Cities Then and Now. And there was a NPR news article on this show, and Tim Nelson photographed me in front of the building at 7th and Wabasha, which in my photograph in the show is 7th Street is still there, you know, and you can look down and see Woolworths. And I realized that I'd also done that in 1995 for Twin Cities Then and Now. So I, you know, here I was as a now and a then. Yeah. And as far as Twin Cities Then and Now goes, I keep thinking it's time. It's almost 25 years. It's time to do the second edition of the Twin Cities Then and Now Again, because huge numbers of those things that I did in 95 are gone, particularly in Minneapolis.
If you followed that arrow to Miller Hospital, you'd get to the Minnesota Historical Society. And there was a saying back in the 70s that a child born in Miller Hospital could look out the window and see the things that would control the rest of her life. The cross on the top of the cathedral, the golden dome on the top of the Capitol, and the big number one on the top of the First National Bank. Can we go to the next one? Okay.
Did Zacharias become the sheriff?
Yeah. Yeah, we think this woman is Pat Hart. She's handing out a flyer on Landmark Center, but she, for a while, and a couple, two of her friends had a music shop in the building. She was a very strong proponent of the arts in downtown St. Paul.
This shot is not in the show. Yeah.
Okay, George, Town Square.
This is what you call confession time? Do you mind showing a few things that were not a disaster? There was a great civil servant in PED who came to me, Doug Foster. Doug Foster came to me, and we were, you know, you remember before we got Canada to come here, Don Love and Oxford Development, you remember how barren it was and empty, and it's a typical thing when you just want to get somebody here. Don Love, the Canadian, we went up there to Edmonton and seen his work, and he delivered everything he promised. Don Love was a good developer, had a successful mixed-use development, very large, in Edmonton, and we were contemplating something like that here. Several major mistakes. Doug Foster came to me, and he said, I've looked at the original plans, and those towers are cookie cutters right out of Skidmore Owens in Chicago. and they're going to be ugly, Mayor, and you shouldn't, you ought to talk to Love about it. Well, Love and I had very good relations, but contrary to what people might think, I actually never did my own negotiating with developers. I really never did. And everybody thinks I'm a big negotiator. I think it's racism. It's because I'm part Lebanese and they think I'm naturally a traitor, you know. So I visited Don Love, who really was a good man. And I said to Don, Don, my really good civil servant said to me that these towers are going to be bad, monolithic, blocking things out, not reflecting the character of our city. I wonder if you can rethink that. And what he said should send chills up the spine of any philosopher who's not a relativist. And he said, Mayor, what kind of ice cream do you like, chocolate or vanilla? And he went on to say, it's all a matter of taste. In other words, it was just a matter of taste. Well, it isn't just a matter of taste. I used to take the students, and I don't know if I relented, but we had tools we could have used, but we never did. And I just kind of kept my fingers crossed and hope it wouldn't be that ugly. It is ugly. And I've taken the student, any of you built it? I'm sorry. And I would take my students downtown from McAllister. And I said, the importance of architecture. I'm not saying you have to rebuild or decide exactly what quality every building is. I said, I just want you to do two things. And I would walk them to the Oxford Towers, which is now the Bremer Towers, you call it. I said, just look at that. And then we're going to go, and I showed them Ben Thompson's masterpiece, The Ordway Theater, which looks out and respects this great old park, which you can walk into and you feel as though you're part of the city. It's not blocked off from anything. I said, I want you to look at that, and then send me essays, and they did. And I said, and please give me your conclusion. If you think one of those buildings is beautiful, say so. If you think one of the buildings is ugly, say so. And McAllister students are pretty independent. And if anything, they would probably like to say something that would be opposite whatever I think. But it's just amazing. No one can look at Oxford Towers and say they're beautiful, can they? And no one could look at Ben Thompson's treasure and gift to us, along with a lot of rich people, and not say, that's beautiful, that's beautiful. And it was pretty late in life for me to understand that architecture is that profound in the life of a city.
Do you want to say anything?
I agree with that.
So let's look at the skyways for a second. So you were taking pictures in the skyways, but we didn't have many of them in this exhibit. Can you tell us what you were thinking about when you were photographing in the skyways?
I really think they were kind of antiseptic spaces. That was my... Yeah, as best I remember that, and particularly looking at my proof sheets of all the shots I took in the skyways, and then I photographed some small businesses in, I think, the Rossmore building. And they were very, they had great texture and very homey feeling to the shops, and there were people living there, and then I think of the skyways, and they're, just from point A to point B, people just moved. And there were shops in there, and people worked in them, but the spaces were not they didn't encourage wandering around.
Everybody wanted one, that's all I can tell you.
Yeah, Jack?
We always bragged about the fact that these are public sidewalks and they're not private. And near the end of my career, I said, that's such a blessing. I wish the private had it. You know, how can they do worse than we did?
Yeah. Jerry?
Well, I did a whole series of photos at the farmer's market, and there was a lot of activity. This was, 78 was before Lower Town was fully redeveloped. There, Mears Park was there in its early configuration, and there were things happening, starting to happen in Lower Town, but I don't know what it looks like. I've been there, but I wasn't looking at it. Is that the same structure that was it? Well, I think it.
It is.
Yeah. Where was that?
You're right. It was up from Lower Town, and where Embassy Suites now is, and the market. My wife used to get the cheap
Eisenberg. Why don't you talk about the move of the market?
Well, I wish Dick Broeker could tell the whole history. The old market really was quite wonderful. I mean, everybody used it. Didn't everybody like the old market? I mean, we used it a lot. But we had, I think Embassy Suites was an opportunity, and Lower Town was emerging, and Broeker had this idea that transferring Farmers Market to Lower Town would be a great idea, and that we could make some of those buildings an extension of the market, so it'd be a four-season market. That was part of his vision. And I don't know, my memory fades about the details of how we, anybody want to comment about, needless to say, this is St. Paul. So anything you want to change, you can fill this room twice. Any kind of change. I remember when we built Energy Park and Parade, our Midway Stadium, a pig of a stadium that ever existed. I'd been there with eight other people watching my son play American Legion baseball, but nobody used it. It was ugly. And when we were going to move that, it turns out it was a historic treasure. And it was the same way with the old farmer's market. It was good. But that's a beautiful part of the love of our history and preservation. So there was a lot of resistance. Why are you changing a good deal like that? And the new farmer's market, I think, has worked very well over the years. And that was Broeker. And I'm sorry, but there were several local people he worked with, farmer market people. Do you remember any names? And there was a woman who was the head of the organization, but in any event, Patty. So he had to work a lot with the produce people and the farmers, as well as the historic preservationists. And I never met any of them. That's the benefit of being the mayor. Broeker would meet them, and we'd work it out.
Hey, it's Bill Lindeke again. This was an inaudible question here about the value of meetings with the public. So the questioner claimed that a lot of urban situations in the 70s and 80s, there was a lot of engagement from the city and they had a lot of meetings and the public got involved. And he claimed that urban policies fail in cases where the public is not involved, that public engagement is better than top-down decisions where people in the public were not consulted. And then former Mayor Latimer responded, so you'll hear that response right now.
Wei Ming Lu. And he did not get them to do that. I got them to do that, and everybody seems to forget about it. The other day, it's terrible to be alive and read that John Manillo got the money. I remember vividly. I had a David Stanley and Broeker, and we were going up to the mountaintop to talk to McKnight, and we were going to ask for $10 million. And Stanley said, now, you got to remember, Binger. Binger is going to be saying to you, well, $10 million is a lot of money, and you just have to be ready to tell him you need all $10 million. And Jim Binger, if God is not available, he would be a good understudy. And so, and they, by the way, they know what they're doing. Not only are you presenting to them from their board chair situation, but that's elevated. So it's kind of episcopal. It's sort of like, you know, the cardinal is up there. And so Jim looked down at me and he said, well, Mayor, $10 million, exactly what they warned me, he would say. $10 million, a lot of money. And I said, Mr. Binger, with this kind of vision and what we want to do over the years, anything less, we're just not going to fulfill that vision. So I lied straight out. Not the first time. And because of Russ Ewald and his wonderful management of that foundation, we knew that we were pretty sure to get it. And we all went into the elevator. And then one of us shouted an obscenity that we thought we had pulled it off. I think it was me. And it really was something, but I didn't mean to get into that, but thank you for letting me. I want to get back to Rick's point. I can't tell you the number of times that people in neighborhood groups would say things that were just, oh, why hadn't we thought of that? I don't know if you remember this, but we had a $100 million sewer separation project in the late 70s, was it? And so that was huge, right? I think it was the biggest infrastructure at the time. And we also had tree planting, and at the same time we had a curbing program. And so a guy got up from the north side, the north end, I mean, and he said, Mayor, you know, do any of you guys have any brains? Because you're building tunnels here, and you're going to lay pipe there, and then you're going to plant trees there. For crying out loud, get your act together and time it one at a time. Otherwise, you're going to, you know. And I'm not saying, Alan, that you didn't think of that. But the fact is we did not have a coordinated program of curbing, tunneling. We didn't have it until this guy got up and said, Latimer, you know, do a little thinking. So there were so many examples of people letting you know. And when the people mover got defeated, I wasn't at all surprised because I could tell people never did buy it. The only thing I wrote down in preparation for this meeting was ugly, goofy, and risky. That's how they identified my favorite project. And it really was, people never bought the idea. And to your point, and this goes to politics and governance and making decisions. Yes, you do. And except for, I mean, there are a lot of issues people are going to disagree with you on. But you have to absorb it first. And then if it's not a matter of principle, if it's a stop sign, I'm just going to give you one more war story. St. Anthony Park. Does everybody know St. Anthony Park? Does anybody dare live there? Nobody lives in St. Anthony Park? You're admitting it. Okay. It's a very special neighborhood. They are pounding me week after week. Raphael, you'll appreciate this. They wanted a stop sign at Carter and Doswell. I didn't even know where Carter and Doswell was, but I was tired of it. So I had the traffic and the public works people. I said, let's do this. Mayor, it's not going to help the traffic. It's not going to do anything to help. I said, will it hurt anybody? No. Put the damn semaphore in there. And when I did, they had, this is by the way, listening to the people, but not the people who were advising me. So when they had the semaphore lighted, because it's St. Anthony Park, they had a short grandstand, a three-piece string group playing. They had an oration from the head of the, it's not far from the school. The words have trouble coming out of my mouth. Seminary, I had trouble remembering seminary. Anyway, and he gave this wonderful talk to introduce me, and he said that this semaphore could not help but remind him of Kierkegaard's essay on the joy of walking. True story. Now, only in St. Anthony Park would a red light remind somebody of Kierkegaard, but that's St. Paul.
He left one part of that story out, that the people in St. Anthony Park vote. And he was very conscious of the votes in St. Anthony Park.
Thanks for listening to the Streets MN podcast. If you're interested in joining a conversation about Minnesota's transportation and land use, direct your browser to streets.mn. Content for Streets MN is volunteer-driven, and the views reflected on